While I'm certainly not the king of the world, I like to think that I'm one of the most academically honest anthropologists in the world. Because rather than push any given political agenda, I go where the truth takes me, which can be difficult to discern because the academically accepted interpretation of truth is dictated by corporate entities and bankers that are anything but academic. As most people know, Hollywood movies have been used for decades now to sway and manipulate public opinion for purposes of social engineering, or to omit certain scenarios from historic events altogether. Just think of any blockbuster movie that is based on historic events, and you'll find that it's riddled with overt propaganda and historic inaccuracies, whether it be about World War II, or the alleged peopling of the Americas, or movies like the Titanic, which had a $200 million budget, which was unheard of in 1997 when it was released. While this episode will focus on the true story behind the sinking of the Titanic on its maiden voyage, I'd like to open with a tribute to a truth seeker who also tackled this subject before the modern internet age, and whose research impacted me on my own path when I first started peeking behind the veil, even if I don't share all of his same conclusions in my current perspective. Eustace Mullins passed away in 2010 and is still defamed for his politically controversial views, which have often been labeled as conspiracy theories, but seem to have been prophetic in hindsight. Mullins wrote about an elite class of globalist bankers that he claimed were behind many of the wars and depressions that adversely affect all people of all races worldwide. He wrote about the Federal Reserve, which came about in 1913, but tied it to earlier central banking systems, which he traces all the way back to biblical times. While I did not read all of his books, and am not familiar with all of his theories, he has left behind numerous videos from conferences where he spoke out against what he believed to be corruption in finance, big pharma, academia, and the global media. Eustace claimed that several high-profile bankers had conspired to write the Federal Reserve Act for their own nefarious purposes and then induced Congress to enact it into law. That said, I appreciate his contribution in bringing attention to secret meetings held on Jekyll Island, which took place in the early 20th century, shortly before the sinking of the Titanic and the subsequent formation of the Federal Reserve. Jekyll Island is located off the coast of the U.S. state of Georgia and is currently run by a self-sustaining, self-governing body. While it is owned by the state of Georgia since 1947, before that, much of its land was privately owned, beginning in the colonial era, with secretive events that took place on the island during the early 20th century being central to today's episode. At the end of November 1910, some of the most influential men in America gathered on Jekyll Island for a secret meeting. Their names were Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, who was the leader of the Republican Party, Adam P. Andrew, who was Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Department, Frank Arthur Vanderclip, who was President of the National City Bank of New York, Henry P. Davison, was also a prominent banker, Benjamin Strong, who was another important banker, and Paul Wahlberg, who, you guessed it, was another influential banker. The purpose of the secret meeting was to plan the country's monetary policy and establish a central banking system, which resulted in the draft legislation for what eventually became the creation of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Of course, there's a gap there, from when the meeting took place in 1910 and the establishment of the Federal Reserve in 1913, which I'll get into. But first, allow me to briefly define what the Federal Reserve is. Although it has the word federal in it, which by definition implies it has something to do with the central government, in reality, it is the name of a group of private banks owned by private citizens such as the Rothschild banking family that prints currency, then loans this paper currency to the United States on interest. So rather than the US government printing its own currency backed by gold or silver, as stated in the US Constitution, this legislation made it so instead the US borrows paper printed by a group of private bankers that collect interest on every dollar printed, backed by nothing. This ability to print and loan money on interest is what financed both world wars, drowning the nation in debt, and why $1 in 1913 is equal to $25 today.
So in effect, we're financing our trade with China and trade with Japan by our Federal Reserve currency, which is neither federal, it's not federal, any more than the Federal Express Company is a federal company. And it has no reserves because it doesn't need any reserves because it prints its own currency. If you could print your own money, what do you need of reserves? You just go and warm up the printing press and turn out another $10 billion. So, finally, it's not a system. It's called the Federal Reserve System. It's not federal. It has no reserves. And it's not a system, but I'm the only person in the world who's ever defined it in my works as a criminal syndicate. And that's what it is. It's a criminal syndicate, just like the Mafia, which is one of its subsidiaries, and the CIA and all of the criminal syndicates work out of the Federal Reserve System. Because that's what a Federal Reserve System is. A central bank is a group of bankers which have total control of a nation's economy. And they print their own money, print as much as they want to, and it eventually becomes worthless. And I defined in my work that a central bank's principal role is for war finance, because war finance is the most profitable enterprise you can get into. And so if you're a banker, you're looking for the best investment you can make, which is a war.
Most intelligent people might think that this system is not only unconstitutional, but is unwise, resembling a Ponzi scheme, and designed to make a small group of bankers extremely wealthy at the expense of the working middle class, which gets stuck with inflation and debt. You might also think that surely there must be some sort of opposition to this financial corruption. What about them? This brings us back to those critical years, between the secret Jekyll Island meeting of 1910 and 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed into law. To understand what happened to the opposition to the central bankers, we need to take a look at a man named J.P. Morgan, an American financier and banker who dominated corporate finance on Wall Street during the late 1800s, when he was a driving force behind the wave of industrial consolidation in the United States, spearheading the formation of several prominent multinational corporations, including U.S. Steel Corporation and General Electric, with controlling interests in AT&T, Western Union, and 24 railroads. J.P. Morgan funded and built the Titanic, as well as its sister ship called the Olympia. While there is much written on theories involving an insurance scam, where the damaged twin ship Olympia was really the ship that sank in an effort to collect insurance money on an already partially damaged vessel. I won't be addressing that conspiracy theory at this time, but there are several interesting videos by others available online for those interested. Instead, I'd like to focus on the fact that J.P. Morgan was booked on the maiden voyage but canceled the day before. The same fortunate outcome cannot be said for the most wealthy and influential opponents to the creation of the Federal Reserve Act, American millionaires who did not owe their fortunes to banking, such as Jacob Astor, one of the richest people in the world at the time, whose wealth in today's money was the equivalent of $2.25 billion, whose fortune was built in real estate, inheritance from fur trading, and as an inventor, incidentally a friend of Nikola Tesla, and he was a lieutenant colonel in the Spanish-American War. Another opponent to the Federal Reserve Act on board was Benjamin Guggenheim, son of a wealthy miner, who again was not a banker, and either was Isidor Strauss, owner of Macy's department store, who, like the other successful non-banker businessman I just named, seemed too unlucky or too unable to seem to make it aboard a life raft and instead died going down with the ship. It's interesting to note that there were no red flares on board to signal any boats for rescue. Only white flares that signal a party or that everything's okay. Yet these wealthy and politically influential men opposed to the Federal Reserve were invited aboard the Titanic for its maiden voyage, the same trip that J.P. Morgan conveniently decided to back out from at the last minute, with no Rockefellers and no Rothschilds on board, all major opposition perishing aboard the ship in 1912, with the Federal Reserve Act established the following year during the holiday season, passed through Congress when most were not even present.
Paul Warburg himself, who was the author of the act, and the other bankers had to, for the first time in their life, come down to Washington and lobby in the halls of Congress to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. And of course, they had to make a lot of promises, a lot of commitments, a lot of bribes. But since they printed the money, it didn't matter. So they bribed the Congress to enact the Federal Reserve Act, which was signed, but they still could not get a majority vote. So they had to wait till the Christmas vacation after Lindbergh and the Middle Western and Western congressmen had departed for Christmas vacation. Then they brought the Federal Reserve Act before Congress on December 23rd after the opposition had left. But they still had a quorum. They still could pass it. And so even the New York Times said, never has legislation of such importance been passed under such circumstances. In other words, the whole Federal Reserve Act was passed through fraud, was passed more or less while Congress was in Christmas vacation. And Wilson signed the act into law on December 23rd, practically Christmas Eve, and it became public law. So now that they had a central bank with the power to print all the money they wanted, a privately owned bank. And the Federal Reserve Act itself is an amazing act. It's an act of total monopoly because every word in it, first of all the money that the bankers can print becomes an obligation of the U.S. government, which means the U.S. taxpayer. Second, the stockholders of this private bank included in the legislation that no Federal Reserve Bank stock could ever be bought or sold on any exchange in the world. So in other words, the initial purchasers would own it in perpetuity, which is what happened because the Rothschilds, Warburgs, and Schiffs all bought the original stock in 1914 and have owned it ever since. And they've put it into foundations so it can never be touched. And these foundations are the real government of the United States, Rockefeller Foundation. Nearly all of your major legislation in the United States is prepared by these foundations. And they submit it to Congress, and of course they have enormous staffs and billions of dollars. So they bring the legislation before Congress. And it's impeccable. It's researched and it's phrased and everything is done just right. And so of course the Congress accepts it. And they look around and they say, is anybody objected to any of this? And of course, there's total silence. Nobody objects. So it becomes law. That's why you have laws constantly passed by Congress, which are actively opposed by 85% of the American people. Almost everything that's done in Washington is opposed by 85% of the American people. So you have government by 15%, government by elites. And they're not even Americans. These are international elitists. They have no allegiance whatsoever to the United States, just like your Canadian legislatures have no allegiance to you. They have no allegiance to Canada. They're part of the international elite. But of course, they don't say this publicly, and the press hails them all as great patriots and dedicated people. selfless individuals. They love that word, selfless. Imagine, all your legislators are selfless. They never have a selfish bone in their body because they're working for you. They want to give you things. And, of course, the only purpose they have is to rob you. Not only you, but all 6 billion people in the world, because it's a government of robbery. So you have what you call the new economy in the United States and probably Canada too. And the new economy is simply people working and creating and producing in spite of everything the robbers can do to them. Everything that's accomplished in this country is accomplished in spite of the foundations, in spite of the bankers. People have to work harder to pay the interest, but they do that. They rise to the challenge. At some point, the people will have to make themselves recognized, and they're doing this through the Internet. The big question mark is the Internet, and that's why Washington has been making frantic efforts to control the Internet.
While Eustace is still slandered with derogatory labels, a Marxist tactic that has been effective since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, which I also covered in a prior video, can anyone today deny that overt media censorship exists, regardless of what one's own political ideology is? While the Federal Reserve Act was allegedly passed in an effort to establish economic stability and prosperity in the U.S., by introducing a central bank to oversee monetary policy, one needs only look back at the history of the last century, including both world wars, which were financed by debt, and the subsequent inflation and financial consolidation of power, to see that the economic stability and prosperity was not intended for the general population, but for a small, secretive elite that does not owe its loyalty to any one nation, race, or religion, but to a globalist political agenda opposed to our freedom and committed to our servitude. In actuality, American history is far different from the way it has been presented in modern schools or portrayed on the big screen. Hollywood has a tendency to finance and promote blockbuster movies about historic events, which oftentimes, if not always, camouflages key points with a love story or some other distraction. One example of this is the movie Titanic, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, who put in a great job as an actor, but the film did not do the historic event justice, as it concealed the fact that many influential opponents to the Federal Reserve central banking system lost their lives with the sinking of that ship. It was this notorious incident in 1912 which made the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 possible. One of the most influential and popular documents exposing the formation of the Federal Reserve is a book written in 1994 by G. Edward Griffith called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which recounts a secret meeting that took place in 1910 on Jekyll Island, a stretch of white sand beaches and beautiful landscape off the coast of Georgia. It was an exclusive gathering of American financiers, politicians, and banking elite who covertly plotted the draft legislation for the creation of the all-powerful central banking system that not only financed both world wars, but has become an accomplice in the support of totalitarian regimes throughout the world. An excerpt from the book claims that, quote, "There are few historians who would challenge the fact that the funding of World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War was accomplished by the Mandrake mechanism through the Federal Reserve System. An overview of all wars since the establishment of the Bank of England in 1694 suggests that most of them would have been greatly reduced in severity, or perhaps not even fought at all, without fiat money. It is the ability of governments to acquire money without direct taxation that makes modern warfare possible, and a central bank has become the preferred method of accomplishing that. We theorize a strategy dubbed the Rothschild Formula, in which the world's money cabal deliberately encourages war as a means of stimulating the profitable production of armaments and keeping nations perpetually in debt. This is not profit-seeking, it is genocide. It is not a trivial matter, therefore, to inquire into the possibility that our elected and non-elected leaders are, in fact, implementing the Rothschild formula today.
When I did my research on this topic, I came to the conclusion, which may startle you folks here, that the Federal Reserve System does not need to be audited. It needs to be abolished. First of all, Jekyll Island is a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia. And it was on that island back in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was conceived at a highly secret meeting that took place there. And what I'd like to do is talk about this meeting and show you that, in fact, the Federal Reserve was created there and that there was a lot of secrecy surrounding it. And then we'll be confronted with the question, why the secrecy? When things are done in secret, there are often things to hide. And we'll explore what it was that they wanted to hide. And when we finally understand what that was, we'll be face to face with one of the most important facts about the Federal Reserve System that is not generally known. In 1910, Jekyll Island was privately owned by a small group of millionaires. In those days, they were millionaires. In today's dollars, they would be billionaires from New York. This is where their families went to spend the winter months. It was a resort island, a resort club. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. And there was a very elaborate clubhouse there, which was the center of their social activities. It's still there, by the way, if anybody wants to visit it. The island has been purchased by the state of Georgia, and this clubhouse has been renovated. It's a beautiful thing. And around this clubhouse, they had cottages, which were built by many of the families that belonged to the club. Cottages are not exactly the word I would have chosen to describe these structures. I remember on taking the tour through one of them, the guide said that there were 14 bathrooms in that cottage. So you have an idea of the kind of elegance that was there. In any event, the number of bathrooms has nothing to do with this story. I just get hung up on that because it's hard for me to imagine a cottage with that much running plumbing. But the important point was that this is where the Federal Reserve System was conceived, is in that clubhouse. So let's tell that story. It all began in November of 1910 when Senator Nelson Aldrich sent his private railroad car to the New Jersey Railroad Station, where there it was in readiness for the arrival of himself and six other men who were instructed to come under conditions of great secrecy. For example, they were told to come one at a time, not to be seen together, not to dine together on the night of their departure. If they had arrived at the same time, they were instructed to pretend as though they didn't even know each other. They were to avoid newspaper reporters because these were well-known men, and had they been spotted by reporters, which often frequented the railroad station, especially had they been seen together, many questions would have been asked. One of the men carried a shotgun in a big black case so that if he had been asked where he was going, he was prepared to say that he was going on a duck hunting trip. And the interesting thing about that little piece of the history is that this man, we find out later from his biographer, never fired a gun in his life. He even had to borrow that shotgun in order to participate in this deception. Even after they got on board the railroad car, this pattern continued. They were told to use first names only, not to use last names. Well, the train traveled for two nights and a day on a 1,000-mile journey to the south, and When they awoke on the second morning, the car was on the siding, the railroad siding at Brunswick, Georgia. And from there, they took the ferry boat across the inland strait to Jekyll Island and to the clubhouse. And for the next 9 days, these men sat around a table and hammered out all the important details of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. And incidentally, if you visit that clubhouse today, you can walk down to the end of the one corridor there, and on a door is a brass plaque. And it says, in this room, the Federal Reserve System was created. When they were done, they got back on board the train, back to New York, and disappeared. And for quite a few years after that, these men denied that any such meeting ever took place. It wasn't until after the Federal Reserve was firmly established that only then did they begin to talk openly about it. They wrote books on it. One of them wrote a magazine article, and they gave interviews to newspaper reporters. And so now, many years later, it's possible for us to go to the public record and find in print detailed descriptions of what happened at that meeting. Well, who were these men? The first one I've already mentioned, the one with the railroad car, Senator Nelson Aldrich, who was the Republican whip in the Senate. He was also chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was that special committee of Congress which was created for the purpose of proposing legislation which was to reform banking. That was the idea. Banking needed reform. And the American people were greatly concerned in those days over things that were going on in the banking industry. People were losing their money in the banks because they weren't keeping their promises to hold their deposits in reserve. There were runs on the bank, and the banks couldn't pay the people back. But most of all, they were concerned over the concentration of financial power that was in the hands of a small group of very powerful and large banks in New York on Wall Street. This is what they called the money trust. That was the name, and it was a very popular expression in the newspapers. And quite a few politicians were elected to office on their campaign promise to break the grip of the money trust. President Wilson was one of those politicians, by the way. So, that was the purpose of the National Monetary Commission, which was to propose legislation, which eventually became the Federal Reserve Act, to break the grip of the money trust over the financial markets of America. Aldrich was a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr., which means, of course, that eventually he became the grandfather of Nelson Rockefeller, our former vice president. You remember his full name was Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller. So he derived his middle name from his famous grandfather. The second person at the meeting was Abraham Piatt Andrew, who was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He later became a congressman, but he was very prominent in banking circles. Frank Vanderlip was there. He was the president of the National City Bank of New York, which was the largest and the most powerful of all the banks in the country. Representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company. Henry Davison was there. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was present. He was the president of the First National Bank of New York, which was another one of the giants. Also, there was Benjamin Strong, who was the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And incidentally, 3 years later, when the Federal Reserve System was finally created, he became the first head of the system. And finally, there was Paul Warburg, who was probably the most important of all the men there because of his knowledge of banking as it was practiced in Europe. Paul Warburg was born in Germany. He eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Kuhn Loeb & Company. He was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And through all the years of his banking in America, he remained in very close contact with his brother, Max Warburg, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the world. And those of you who are Little Orphan Annie fans, you'll remember Daddy Warbucks. Well, Paul Warburg was the real Daddy Warbucks, after whom that character was named. And everyone at the time knew it. I have his photograph in the book. If you'd like to compare his picture to the drawing rendition of Daddy Warbucks, you'll see the similarity between Warbucks and Warburg. And also, while we're on the subject of cartoon characters, anyone who's played Monopoly will remember the drawing of the capitalist with the handlebar mustache and the cigar. That's J.P. Morgan. Those are the seven men who were on Jekyll Island. And as incredible as it may seem, they represented approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world. And these are the men that sat around a table on Jekyll Island and created the Federal Reserve System. What's going on here? Should arouse our curiosity a little bit. It didn't just happen. What's the big deal here? What's wrong with a group of bankers getting together in private and talking about banking or banking legislation? And the answer to that question is provided by Vanderlip himself in the same article. He said, "If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had got together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress. Why not? Because the purpose of the bill was to break the grip of the money trust. And ladies and gentlemen, it was written by the money trust. It's as simple as that. Had that fact been known from the very beginning, the public would never have accepted it as a means of breaking the grip over the money trust. And we would never have had a Federal Reserve System because the scam would have been exposed from the beginning. This was like having the fox build the hen house and install the security system." So there is a primary reason for the secrecy. And it's a fact that most Americans have not even considered, that there might have been some kind of deception, massive deception, at the very inception of the Federal Reserve System, and for a very good reason. But there's more to it than that, a lot more than that. Consider the composition of this group and the financial powers they represented. Is there anything strange about that mixture? Here we had the Rockefellers, we had the Morgans, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, all in one room for 9 days plus 2 days on the train, coming to an agreement. What's going on here? Anything strange about that mixture? Well, ladies and gentlemen, these were competitors. These were the giants in the field which prior to this period had been beating their heads against each other for dominance in the marketplace, for dominance in the financial markets of the world, not only New York, but Paris and London, everywhere. Competitors. This is extremely significant because it happened at precisely that point of American history when business was undergoing a major ideological transition. Prior to this period, America had grown and prospered and surpassed all the countries of Europe as an industrial and economic power because it adhered to the principle of free enterprise competition. And it was in this period that a rapid transition was taking place to the concept of monopoly and cartel. Going back, in fact, to the old world concept, which had held Europe back for all these years. Monopolies and cartels were becoming the order of the day in America. It was John D. Rockefeller the first who said it. He said, "Competition is a sin." He believed it. All of his biographers quote him on that one, by the way. And he and others of these industrialists of the period were devoting all of their time to the elimination of competition. They did not believe in free enterprise competition at all. They knew that the road to riches and power was through the elimination of their competition. And if they couldn't beat their competition out, then they tried to buy them up. If that didn't work, they joined with them in a shared monopoly, and that is a cartel, a shared monopoly. Perhaps I should define that word in more detail so at least you'll know what I'm talking about when I use the word. A cartel is a group of independently owned businesses which come together for the purpose of reducing or eliminating competition between themselves so that they can enhance their profit margins or secure their position in the marketplace. And they do this by price fixing. We won't compete on price. Or they divide up geographical markets or products and services. For example, if we were forming a cartel here, I might say, well, I get the north and you get the south. We won't compete. Or I might insist that I get to produce the gizmo, but you can produce the widget. And we won't compete. Or we'll share patents and processes. We won't compete. And every time we agree to eliminate one area of competition between ourselves, we move closer and closer together until finally we are as one industry insofar as the marketplace is concerned, even though our component parts are independently owned. And that is a cartel. And so that enhances our profits. We can get more for our products and services than we could in the arena of free enterprise competition. And of course, the other side of that coin is that the public pays more for those products or services than they would otherwise. And that is just as true in a banking cartel as it is in any other kind of cartel. And the amazing fact emerges that when you study this period, that for the 15 years before the meeting on Jekyll Island, these groupings of which we're speaking had come together increasingly in joint ventures. They were learning how to avoid competition between themselves. They knew they couldn't knock each other out. They had tried that. It was too costly. Now it was time to come together. And what happened on Jekyll Island is that they formed a banking cartel, and they called it the Federal Reserve System. An amazing fact that all these years we've had something which most people have thought was a government operation of some kind or another. We were told it was a creation to protect the people, to stabilize the economy, and it's a cartel. And the purpose of a cartel is to enhance the profit structure of the members of the cartel. Period.
So 1910, William Howard Taft was president, and the six gentlemen who were there, Nelson Aldrich, Republican whip in the Senate, Henry Davison, senior partner of J.P. Morgan, A. Piatt Andrew, assistant secretary of the Treasury, Frank Vanderlip, president of National City Bank of New York, Benjamin Strong of J.P. Morgan, and Paul Warburg, partner representing the Rothschilds and Warburgs in Europe. And you say that in here that they represented essentially one-fourth of the entire wealth of the world.
Of the entire world. An incredible statement. That's not my appraisal. But that was the opinion of the journalists at the time who were writing about these people. Not in connection with the Federal Reserve, but they were prominent bankers, and they talked about the Jekyll Island Group, for example, and then these bankers in particular, and the investment houses of Kuhn, Loeb and Company, and so forth. But they said these men represented directly through the power that they held in their own hands, and indirectly through the money that was concentrated in the investment firms, like the insurance companies and the banking companies. Put it all together, they said it was one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world. And you know that concentration of wealth has only increased since then?
Well, you asked the question in your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, what is the Federal Reserve, and what is your answer?
Well, what it is, it's a cartel. It's not a government agency. It has the appearance of it being a government agency, and they went to great lengths to give it that facade. It does have the power of government because Congress voted to give the power of enforcement to it. But in its essence, underneath it, it's a cartel. It's nothing different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel or sugar cartel. It happens to be a banking cartel. They got together, they drew up the rules and regulations for their own industry, to self-regulate their own industry is what cartels do, and then they sent it to Congress, and they took off the label at the top that said banking cartel, and they erased that, and they said Federal Reserve Act. Congress passed it into law, and that's why we think it's a government agency, is because if you don't obey the rules that they set down for their own industry, you go to prison. And so it looks like a government agency. But basically, the answer to your question is, it's a banking cartel.
While there's been some movements to combat this globalist totalitarian network, which has not only financed communist revolutions around the world, such as in Russia, China, and more recently in South Africa, which were all triggered by engineered social uprisings aimed to remove existing power structures using class warfare and amplifying socioeconomic and racial tensions enforced by a banker-controlled media. We can see the same pattern played out in America today, where manufactured civil unrest is used to erase history and promote cultural Marxism. In a nation which already promotes falsehoods in schools, starting from its name, which was not really based on the explorer Amerigo Vespucci, whose authentic name was actually Alberigo Vespucci, who only changed his name to Amerigo after his voyages to the Americas. In other words, Amerigo came from America and not the other way around. Not only was there an existing tribe in Nicaragua called Americ, whose root word was the ancient name for the land used by the natives of Peru, also known to the Maya civilization and attributed to the great feathered serpent creator deity, which they called Cucucan, a deity which also had an equivalent by the Aztec civilization. According to Manly P. Hall, in his book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, quote, "These children of the sun adored the plumed serpent, who was the messenger of the sun. He was the god Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, Gucamet in Quiche, and in Peru he was called Amaru. From the latter name comes our word America. Amaruca is, literally translated, land of the plumed serpent. The priests of this flying dragon, from their chief center, they once ruled both Americas. One of their strong centers was Guatemala, and of their order was the author of the book called Popol Vuh. Many Mesoamerican and Native Indian tribes also record in their oral traditions encounters and conflicts with giants, or at least very tall people in the past. I also covered this topic in several videos, showing documentation regarding many discoveries of giant skeletons, which have been published in newspapers, and then seemingly forgotten to history, except for mythology or mentions of giants in the Bible. In many biblical interpretations, the serpent is synonymous with Lucifer, the fallen angel thrown down by God, which literally translates to light-bearer, a symbol which can be found in many parts of the ancient pre-Christian world. In his book, The Occult Connection to the Hidden Race, author Ken Hudal proposes that, quote, "Then perhaps the land of the plumed serpent may also be known as the land of Lucifer," concluding that America means the land of Lucifer. While this interpretation may sound like a real stretch for many, it's an interesting concept when considered from the perspective of an interview that I recently stumbled upon, suggested to me by one of my subscribers, which uncovered some interesting details regarding the secretive meeting on Jekyll Island and events that led up to the creation of the Federal Reserve. The gentleman being interviewed is Tim Bentz, and the host of the show is Rob Skiba, from a broadcast on Blog Talk Radio titled Canaanite Altars and the Federal Reserve. I'll leave a link to the full interview in the description, but now let's listen to a brief excerpt, and I'll leave it to the listener to draw their own conclusions.
I knew something about Jekyll Island. I had looked at some of the financial issues in the 80s and 90s. I was looking at some of the spiritual applications to financial things, but I really was not up to speed on the history of Jekyll Island. I had just heard it from something. I'd not even read the book that's called The Creature of Jekyll Island. I'd not even read that book, but I was aware of something about Jekyll Island and financial stuff. So I went in my brother's house, got my computer out, and I just, got on the internet and typed in Jekyll Island. And it's like, what's going on with Jekyll Island? And so I discovered when I got online that the Jekyll Island Club, which was this historical, multi-millionaires country club that had been built in the turn of the century, it had just been remodeled and reopened. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. When I got to the hotel, it was about 9 o'clock at night. And so I went in the restaurant and had a good meal and went to my room and got some rest. And the next morning I went down for breakfast and a different lady was at the desk, but she had a note for me. It said that I had an appointment arranged with the museum director and that he was blocking out most of the day to spend with me. So I had my breakfast, and then when I went over to meet with him. So I go meet with the museum gentleman. His name is John, and when I go meet with him, I just introduced myself. I told him a little bit about who I was and what I do. We started talking. He was, of course, started out talking about the financial stuff, because this Jekyll Island is where the Federal Reserve banking system was birthed and conceived. And at one time when it was functioning in the 1900s up to the 20s and 30s, some say one-third, some say two-thirds of the world's wealth would vacation on that island. It was the highest conglomeration of wealth in a single place very often anywhere in the world back in the turn of the century. So it just seems like a little island that's not anything significant at all now, but it's amazing to see the financial side of the history of that spot. And so I'm sitting there looking at some of the things that he's telling, and just thinking about some of the things he's telling me. We went out, walked around, and he showed me some of the cottages that had been restored and the club itself and the rack, the tennis courts, and they had a pier where the boats would come up, and he just kind of showed me the grounds, and then we go to the museum. And he's talking a lot about the financial stuff and the guys that built it, and each cottage was, marked and named. Some of them had been restored. Some of them didn't exist anymore, but they had like a sign that this is where this one was, and that one was built by J.P. Morgan, that one was Rockefeller's, and, that one was they had each one of them named. Well, they're all kind of native names. And then they're all, got some kind of a plaque on who the financial mogul was that had built them. And they're not really elaborate, luxurious mansions. They're just simple cottages for the most part, which was kind of interesting to know that the richest people in the world built them, and they were very low-key and almost like a, cabin in the woods instead of a luxurious house like you'd expect. And they all had Indian names. So I started asking him about the Indian history of the island, and he lit up. He just was like, that's what he really wanted to talk about, because he loved the Indian history. And so he takes me back to the museum, and he said, we got a lot of stuff on the Indians. He said, this was actually the government main community for a tribe of Indians that don't exist anymore. And that tribe was called the Timucas. And I said, well, that's interesting. My name's Tim. Anyway, I didn't know anything about the Timucas. I'm from Oklahoma. I've learned a lot of Native history, and I have some Native bloodline, but I did not know anything about the Timucas. So I just asked him, please tell me everything that you can tell me about them. There's something about the Natives that I feel like I need to know. So he said, well, the Jekyll Island Club was actually built on top of everything that the Indians had. So they just kind of wiped the village out and built a club on top of it. So wherever the chief's house was, there was a cottage now. Wherever the council house was, there was now the Jekyll Island Hotel. And he said everything that's built and visible today is actually sitting right on top of something that was significant in the Indian village when it existed. So he said the fact that this whole place had to go into ruins and then be rebuilt and become an archaeological state park, he said, it actually helped us identify the native history because the club itself had almost erased that. And so I said, well, you know, let's look at the museum. I want to see some of the Indian stuff. So we're looking at arrowheads and spear tips and, you know, just artifacts that they had found and pottery shards and things and seashells that they had had. And he showed me all their stuff in the museum. He shows me some fragments of a weapon that was like an unusual bow. And when I say unusual, I mean that it was like a double-curved bow. And that was a very unusual shape of the bow for a native tribe. I had never seen that shape before with an American Indian tribe. And I've seen a lot of bows and arrows. So I asked him, I said, this seems unusual. I've not seen this before. In Oklahoma, every native tribe, the bows would look like a single bow or just a single curve. I said, this is quite extraordinary, especially as far back as this tribe was. So he said, yeah, we found a lot of weapon-type artifacts that we've not seen with other tribes. And I said, well, how do you know these were Native Americans? Maybe they were from somewhere else. He said, oh, no. They were Vatinia because they're well-established along the Florida and Georgia coast, and he said, we got a lot of stuff in three or four states about them, and they were quite prolific at one time. So he said, we know they're Native Americans. I said, well, all right, what else you got? He said, well, we got some skeletons. He said, do you want to see the bones? And I said, well, yeah. You don't get to see a skeleton very often. I said, are they where we can actually see them, or are they buried? He said, no, they're visible. So they had a burial site that they had been very respectful for when they built the museum. When they found a burial site, they didn't move the bones. They left them where they were, and they just uncovered them to where they were visible, and then they built the museum on top of them. They did basically the same thing with the museum that the Jekyll Island guys had done with their houses. They put a piece of plexiglass over the burial site so you could see it, but they were still trying to respect where the bones were and not move them. And so I'm looking at four skeletons of the Temuka chiefs. And they knew they were chiefs just from different things that were buried with them. So all of a sudden I look and I realize, man, these guys are really tall. And I commented to the guy that, you know, how tall are these guys? They look unusually large. And he said, yeah, they're all about 8 or 8.5 foot tall. I thought, well, that doesn't seem like a normal Native American, especially the tribes that I'm familiar with. He said all the Temukas were unusually tall, even the women. And he said, we found other skeletons and, you know, parts of bones out in the grounds. And he said, we've got pretty good evidence that nearly all of them were extraordinarily tall. And I said, well, what is, you know, how do you explain that in relation to other tribes on the Atlantic coast who were not? He said, I don't know. It is an unusual anomaly. He said, oh, by the way, I've got a painting that you might want to see. It's actually the copy of the original. We've got it under lock and key. But he said, I've got a painting that actually shows the Indians from a group of French colonists that came to the United States before it was the U.S. This was right after Columbus. He said that it was the first colony of French folks that came over to try to establish a colony on the coast. And he said they landed in Jekyll Island, and they had some interaction with these Indians. And then they got so appalled by what they saw and witnessed that they fled at night and ended up in San Augustine, Florida, and established that city. So I said, were they the Huguenots who were the French group that established St. Augustine? He said, yes. I said, well, I'd like to see that painting then. So he pulls that out. I'm looking at it, and it shows the Indians and all their regalia, and they're dancing around and having some kind of a ceremony, and it's got the fire, and it's got just, it's a typical, either they're having a party or they're having a war scene, and it has some things with the weapons. So I said, gosh, this has got some weapons in it that clearly validates the archaeology that they found. And then I see an altar. And I'm going, I don't know of a Native American tribe anywhere in the country. I know some that had log houses or high places or worshipped, you know, nature in some way, or had totem poles or that kind of stuff. But this one has a stone altar, and it looks a whole lot like the one that I had dealt with in the Middle East. And I'm looking at the picture, and I'm going, is this an altar? Is this stone like something they're sacrificing on? Because this guy's holding babies in his hands in this picture. He said, yeah, they're cutting those babies. They're hacking those babies up in that painting. And so what, when you look at the details, two of the shamans or chiefs are holding a baby up by the ankles, and they're whacking their heads off and spilling the blood on this altar. And I'm like, sir, I don't want to be disrespectful of your training and archaeological understanding and history, but I don't know of any native tribe that did what I'm seeing here, unless it was an act of war. And this is really, really unusual. And I've seen this type of scene with artifacts over in the Middle East. And I've seen weapons like this over in the Middle East. I said, are you sure this is Native Americans and not some kind of colony that came from over there? And he was convinced they were Native. And I said, well, I'd like to show you some things on a few websites that identify artifacts in the Middle East countries, and especially Egypt and Israel and Syria and Jordan area, and some of those spots where there's some of these ancient groups. And I said, this type of altar, this type of religious ceremony, and some of these weapons, I've seen them before over there. Well, he was quite interested in that because he loves Native American history, but he's starting to question, now, maybe I need to dig into this more. That was his comment. So I said, at that point, then I thought, I believe this is why I'm here. I needed to see this and hear about this. You know, at this point, I'm not that concerned about the financial stuff anymore. I'm wanting to know, where is this altar? And so I asked him, I said, can you take me to this altar? I often pray over these things, and it's very beneficial for the land and for the country and for the people. Can I go to this altar and see it? He said, I can take you to the altar, but you can't see it. And I said, why can't I see it? Is it buried? He said, no, it's not buried, but it has a house built on top of it. I said, who would be crazy enough to build their house on top of a blood sacrifice altar? He said, well, Rockefeller was. So,
nice.
You know, I just, like, okay, can we go there? And he said, yeah, it's just a short walk. Come on. And we've actually, you know, I'd already walked by it. So he said, I've got the keys. He said, normally nobody can go in. The way these things are set up, they're historical homes now. The state of Georgia owns the park. They lease out to another group the hotel to run, but the houses are maintained on the National Historical Register, and they're part of the state park. So you can't go in any of them without a guided tour or permission, but you can go look in the windows and walk on the porches and walk all around them, and they're set up inside just like they were when they were actually being used in the back in the 20s and earlier. So We go over there, and he's got the keys, though. So we go into the house, and he takes me into the parlor, and he says, well, I know you're a praying guy, so you probably would like to have a little time to pray. He said, you're standing right on top of the altar right now. This is the room that is built on top of it. He said, I'm just going to go over here and sit down for a few minutes and read the newspaper, and I'll let you pray and do whatever you need to do.
Now, this parlor, that's where those guys, J.P. Morgan and all those guys, actually conceived of the Federal Reserve, right? Right over that altar.
That's exactly right. It's the room that they were sitting in when they drew up the entire legislation and planned to pass it that became the Federal Reserve Act.
Wow.
So this was the conception of the Federal Reserve banking system. On the parlor, sitting on top of a blood sacrifice altar.
Where babies were sacrificed.
Yes. And so all of a sudden it's like, wow, no wonder our banking system has so much corruption in it, even when people want to do the right thing, you know.
No kidding.
And so, just being a banker is not an easy job, but it's like, not all of them are bad guys, but it's like, wow. And that was not what our founders set up. That took over. It usurped the authority of the way our founding fathers suggested that we bank as a country. And even the way it was passed had a lot of, you know, things that didn't seem right about it. But the idea that it was conceived like this, I'm going, this is not just a bunch of wealthy guys that got away for vacation and came up with a profitable business plan. This has got something diabolical, something occultic about it, something evil that's wrapped up with it.
Yeah.
And so even if it had been a good idea and something beneficial for the country, which many would argue that it was, this demonic power must have gotten into it. Because they didn't just create a bank. They created a banking system that every one of us have become subject to. So think about this. We've got a piece of money that wouldn't be of any value whatsoever if we didn't attribute value to it. Our dollars are only worth something because they're measured
right.
against something else. And the problem
right.
worldwide is every nation today, every nation is operating with fiat currency, and we're the ones that taught them how to do it. The change that the Federal Reserve did was not just to change the facial picture on the money. What they did is they took the right that our Constitution gave to the Treasury Department to print the money and set the value thereof. And they said, let us print it for you, and then we'll loan it back to you.
Right.
Think about the stupidity of that.
That's just crazy.
Wisely, I'm already making something with my own hands, and then somebody else comes to me and says, let me make that for you, and then I'll loan it back to you.
At interest.
Why would I do that?
I know.
It's mine to start with. I don't need you to print it for me and then charge me interest to have it. But that's what we did. We set that up on a national scale. And where was the voice of the righteous when that happened? Why was there not a public outcry? It forces us to have debt or we have no economy.
Yeah.
You cannot buy anything in this country without a debt being created, because if you buy something, that's the reason they print a dollar. So
right.
You buy a house and you ask for a loan, they print the money so they can give you the loan. That creates debt whether you are borrowing or not. Every sale, every transaction, every exchange has to create a debt now to be done. So that is not necessary, but it is something we chose to allow.
And unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, the show cut off right about this point in the broadcast.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.